Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling, well, a really huge and honestly kind of mind-bending claim.
It definitely is.
The idea that entire nations, when they're facing their absolute darkest hours, behave almost exactly like individuals going through intense personal trauma recovery.
Mm-hmm.
We're diving deep into Jared Diamond's fascinating book, Upheaval, Turning Points for Nations in Crisis.
And that core idea, that hook, is provocative, isn't it?
It really is. He's basically saying that the path a nation takes, you know, when it's hit by war or economic collapse or some huge political shock, we can predict that path using the same tools a therapist might use with a patient.
Right.
But I mean, isn't that a massive leap applying like one person's trauma recovery framework to, say, 300 million people? It sounds huge.
It does sound huge. And I think that's exactly why the book grabs you. Our mission today really is to unpack how Diamond tries to bridge that gap. You know, the one between the therapist couch and the government cabinet meeting.
Okay.
He's essentially laid out this systematic 12-factor analytical guide. And it's derived directly from clinical psychology, from crisis therapy, actually.
Wow, okay.
And he uses it to assess national resilience and even predict whether a society is likely to come out stronger from upheaval or if it might just collapse.
So it's like a diagnostic tool for countries.
In a way, yes. And this matters so much right now, doesn't it? I mean, look around. Global polarization, the climate crisis looming, resource depletion.
Yeah, we're definitely at some turning point.
Exactly. National, global turning points. Diamond gives us this blueprint, and it's rooted in history, showing that recovery isn't just some historical accident. It's a conscious, step-by-step process. Nations have choices.
Okay, so to really get this methodology, we probably need to understand the author a bit better. Jared Diamond. He's known as a polymath, right?
That's the word you hear a lot. He's an American academic, a professor of geography at UCLA. But interestingly, his original PhD isn't in geography or history.
Oh, what is it in?
Physiology.
Physiology. Huh. That's unexpected.
It is. And I think that unique background is what lets him synthesize things, history, anthropology, biology, geography, science, in a way that very few others can.
He's looking for the big patterns then. Not just the stories.
Precisely. He's hunting for these large-scale, almost predictable patterns in human history.
Oh.
Upheaval is kind of the concluding part of an unofficial trilogy he wrote.
Right. There was Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Which was about how certain societies gained power, why history unfolded differently on different continents.
And then collapse.
Which looked at how societies lost power. They failed, basically.
Mm.
Environmental damage, bad decision-making.
So Upheaval is the third piece. It's about bouncing back.
Exactly. It's about the conscious choice to survive and rebuild after crisis hits. And what makes his perspective really distinctive here is how he grounds this huge macro historical analysis in, well, clinical psychology.
You mentioned his wife.
Yes. He explicitly brings in lessons from his own personal life crises and significantly from his wife's work as a psychotherapist. It makes the whole, sometimes abstract process of history feel intensely human. Personal, almost.
Okay, so let's walk through the book itself. The central idea is national crises act like forced therapy sessions.
That's a great way to put it. A foreign invasion, maybe, or a sudden civil war, or even just a profound economic shock.
Yeah.
It shakes the nation so fundamentally that it has to reevaluate everything.
Its identity, its core values.
Yeah, and its basic methods of coping. The old ways just don't work anymore.
And that's where his toolkit comes in, the 12 factors.
Exactly. Part one of the book is where he lays out these dozen factors. They're drawn straight from individual crisis therapy literature, but he argues they scale up to the national level. This is really the heart of the book, this checklist for survival, you could call it.
A crisis checklist for nations.
Okay. Things like acknowledging the crisis exists, accepting national responsibility, getting help from others, learning from models.
And then in part two, he takes this checklist
and applies it rigorously to 7 detailed case studies. Real historical examples. Finland during the Winter War, post-war Japan, Germany after WWII, Chile under Pinochet, Indonesia, Australia.
So he's not just telling the history, he's actually like scoring them against these psychological criteria.
That's exactly it. He methodically scores their responses and their resilience based on that same 12-factor framework. It's quite systematic.
In part three, where does he go from there?
That's where the book pivots hard to the present day. He takes this whole historical and psychological framework he's built.
and points it squarely at the challenges facing the United States and really the whole world right now.
Right. He uses the patterns he identified in those historical case studies to offer a kind of roadmap. How can we navigate modern threats like, you know, deep political polarization, systemic inequality, environmental breakdown?
Does he offer hope?
He does. He concludes with what feels like a very necessary cautious optimism. It's not predetermined failure. There are pathways.
Okay, let's really get into the engine room then, this crisis checklist. If a nation is really struggling, what are the specific factors drawn from therapy that he says determine success or failure?
Well, the most obvious starting point, and it's factor one, is acknowledgement that one is in a crisis. You can't solve a problem you refuse to see.
Sounds basic, but probably harder than it looks for a whole country.
Absolutely. Denial is a powerful force, individually and collectively. Then there's acceptance of responsibility. Nations, like individuals, have to accept their share of responsibility for getting into the crisis and for getting out of it. Blaming everyone else doesn't work.
Okay, acknowledge the crisis, take responsibility. What else is key?
Another huge one is honest self-appraisal. This means realistically assessing national strengths and weaknesses. What are we good at? Where are we falling short? And doing it without, you know, defensiveness or wishful thinking.
That sounds like it requires real national maturity.
It does. And building on that, there's building protective fences. This is interesting. It's about defining the specific problems you need to solve, drawing boundaries around them so you're not overwhelmed trying to fix everything at once. Make the crisis manageable.
Okay. Focus your efforts.
Right. And related is getting help from others. Successful nations, like successful individuals, often need support. That could be economic aid, military alliances, or even just adopting good ideas for elsewhere. National pride can get in the way here.
Don't be too proud to ask for help or learn from others. Makes sense.
Then there's using other nations as models. Who has successfully dealt with a similar crisis before? What can we learn from them?
And things like ego strength. How does that apply to a country?
He defines national ego strength as sort of a realistic sense of national self-worth and confidence. It's the belief that you can cope, that you have value distinct from just nationalism or arrogance.
Okay. And flexibility, patience.
Yes. Flexibility is critical, being willing to experiment with new solutions when the old ones fail. And patience recognizing that deep crises often require long-term solutions, not quick fixes. There's also core values, knowing what's truly fundamental to your identity that must be preserved. And finally, freedom from constraints are geopolitical realities or internal divisions preventing necessary action. That's the dozen.
That's a comprehensive list. Let's see it applied. You mentioned Germany after World War II as Diamond's gold standard.
Yeah, he presents post-war West Germany as a prime example of successful national recovery from utter devastation, moral, political, physical ruin.
What did they do right according to the checklist?
Their success, he argues, was fundamentally rooted in that incredibly profound, honest self-appraisal. It wasn't quick or easy, but through this long, difficult process they call Vergangenheitsbewältigung.
Right, coming to terms with the past.
Exactly. They systematically, publicly, unflinchingly acknowledged the horrors of the Nazi era and accepted national responsibility for the Holocaust. It wasn't just politicians saying sorry. It was embedded in education, in memorials, in law.
And Willy Brandt kneeling in Warsaw.
And that's the iconic moment, isn't it?
Mm.
Chancellor Brandt spontaneously kneeling at the Warsaw Ghetto Memorial in 1970. Diamond sees that as more than just politics. It was this visceral public embodiment of accepting responsibility. And that moral reckoning became the bedrock for rebuilding a stable democratic identity. They passed the honest self-appraisal test with flying colors.
Okay, a very different kind of crisis faced Meiji Japan in the 1850s. That was external pressure, right?
Okay.
Commodore Perry's black ships.
Totally different trigger.
Yep.
Perry's arrival shattered Japan's centuries of isolation and brutally exposed their military and technological inferiority to the West. Existential threat, but external.
And their response highlights a different factor from the checklist.
Absolutely. Diamond emphasizes their incredible flexibility and, crucially, selective change. This is key. They didn't just stubbornly cling to every single tradition.
They chose what to keep and what to ditch.
Precisely. The leadership made conscious, rapid decisions. What's absolutely core to being Japanese? The emperor's role, certain social structures, maybe keep those. What's holding us back needs to go. Feudal domains, the samurai class as warriors, outdated industry.
So they adopted Western tech and military structures.
Ruthlessly and incredibly fast. They industrialized, built a modern navy and army, reformed government all based on Western models. But crucially, they did it selectively to preserve what they saw as their core cultural identity. That ability to distinguish and adapt, that flexibility saved them.
That's fascinating. How does Finland compare? They faced the Soviet Union in 1939, overwhelming odds.
Another external crisis, another path to survival. Finland, during the Winter War, also engaged in really clear-eyed, honest self-appraisal. They knew they couldn't ultimately defeat the Soviet military machine in a prolonged war.
So what did they do?
They demonstrated a different kind of selective change, what Diamond calls pragmatic compromise. It was painful, but they chose survival over total resistance.
This is Finlandization.
Yes. They eventually ceded territory, about 10% of their land, to the USSR. And they agreed to align their foreign policy, essentially promising neutrality that wouldn't threaten Soviet interests.
But in return?
In return, they preserved their domestic independence, their democracy, their capitalist economy, their core identity. They sacrificed territory and some foreign policy freedom. They built a fence around those issues to save everything else. Another example of pragmatic selective change based on a realistic assessment.
Okay, so Germany, Japan, Finland, they face these huge, often external shocks. But Diamond also looks at internal crises, right? Or gradual ones.
He does. And those often require leaning on different factors in the checklist. Internal trauma can be even more corrosive in some ways.
Like Chile after Pinochet.
Exactly. The crisis wasn't an invading army. It was years of brutal state-sponsored violence, disappearances, torture, deep social division under the dictatorship. That didn't just damage infrastructure, it shattered the national ego strength, their self-image, as a stable democratic nation.
So how does a nation recover from that kind of internal wound?
Diamond emphasizes the need for immense patience and a long, slow process of working through symptoms, dealing with the traumas, repercussions. You can't just flip a switch. Chile had to painstakingly rebuild democratic institutions, consensus, social trust, deal with truth and reconciliation. It took decades. Internal upheaval shreds the social fabric, and mending it requires incredible patience.
And then there's Australia. That wasn't a dictatorship or a war.
No, Australia's case is different again. Diamond frames it as a slower, more gradual, almost creeping identity crisis.
In what sense?
The slow realization over decades that its historical identity tied to Britain, to Europe, was no longer aligned with its geography or its economic future, which clearly lay in Asia.
Ah, so a psychological shift was needed.
Yes. And that required its own form of painful, slow, selective change, like dismantling the racist white Australia policy, which took a long time and faced resistance. And it requires an ongoing, honest self-appraisal about its relationship with its indigenous population, its place in the region.
So upheaval isn't always sudden and violent. It can be this gradual, difficult psychological adjustment for a whole nation.
Absolutely. It shows the framework applies even when there aren't tanks in the streets. It's about how nations cope with fundamental challenges to their identity and ways of operating.
Okay, we've explored the history, the checklist, the case studies. Let's try to distill this. If you had to pull out the biggest messages from upheaval for us today, what would they be?
I think theme one is simply how powerful and useful the personalist political analogy actually is. It sounds like a stretch at first, but Diamond makes a compelling case that the psychological dynamics we understand in individual recovery, things like accepting responsibility, seeking help, being patient, honest self-assessment, these really do offer a verifiable roadmap for national resilience.
So it reframes history. It's not just dates and battles. It's collective psychological adaptation.
Exactly. It gives us a different lens. Theme two, which we saw again and again in the case studies, is that selective change is essential for survival. It's not optional.
You can't just freeze and hope the storm passes.
Right. And you can't just change everything randomly either. Adaptation requires real wisdom. The ability to distinguish between the core values and identities that must be preserved and the outdated practices or structures that must be jettisoned to survive.
Like Japan keeping the emperor but ditching the feudal system?
Precisely. If you try to save everything unchanged, Diamond implies, you might end up losing everything.
And the third big theme, it sounds like there's a warning in there, especially for some countries.
There is. Theme three is the warning for the U.S. specifically, though it applies elsewhere too. Diamond argues pretty forcefully that America's long history of success, geographic isolation, abundant resources, political power, has ironically fostered a dangerous sense of exceptionalism.
A feeling that the rules don't apply, or that problems aren't as bad as they seem.
Kind of. And this exceptionalism, he warns, actively hinders that crucial factor, honest self-appraisal. It makes it harder to acknowledge the depth of current crises, whether it's political polarization, economic inequality, infrastructure decay.
So failing to even admit the patient is really sick makes treatment impossible.
That's the core of his warning. That failure of self-appraisal, driven by past success, could be the nation's greatest vulnerability, according to his own checklist.
Wow. Okay. The book isn't just analysis. You mentioned it has some really memorable lines that capture these ideas.
He's very good at that, boiling down complex thoughts into potent sentences.
Let's share a few key ideas. One that really reframes the whole concept of crisis for me was something like, a crisis isn't defined just by the external problem itself,
but by the point at which your usual methods of coping and problem solving become inadequate. Yeah, that's powerful.
It really is. It means the crisis point is when your old playbook fails. That's the moment that forces change, but also implicitly gives you the agency to write a new playbook.
And that connects directly to the responsibility piece.
Yeah.
Another core idea is the hallmark of successful crisis resolution is honest self-appraisal.
A country's acknowledging that it faces big problems and that it bears responsibility for solving them, that hits hard.
It does. It cuts through the blame game. Recovery starts with accountability. You have to own the problem to fix it.
And despite the tough diagnoses and warnings, there's still an underlying message of hope, isn't there?
Definitely. He says something to the effect of, nations, like people, possess agency. Their futures are not predetermined.
The histories in this book are not just stories of what happened, but examples of what is possible. That's crucial.
It leaves you with a sense that choices matter. History isn't destiny.
So how can we, you know, regular people, apply these big ideas in our own lives or work?
Well, on a really personal level, you could almost take that 12-factor checklist and apply it to any major life challenge you're facing. A job loss, maybe, or a relationship breakdown, a health crisis.
How would that work?
You'd ask yourself, am I truly acknowledging the depth of this crisis? Am I taking responsibility for my part? Am I building a fence around the immediate problem to make it manageable, not getting overwhelmed? Am I looking for models, people who've successfully navigated something similar? Am I using my ego strength, my core sense of self-worth, to keep going?
It provides a structure for thinking through personal chaos.
Exactly. It gives you actionable steps.
What about in an organization?
Yeah.
A business leader facing disruption?
Same principles apply. That concept of selective change is vital for businesses.
Yeah.
You have to identify, what are our absolute core competencies, our core values, our unique identity? That's what we preserve.
And then be ruthless about.
About jettisoning the outdated business models, the legacy systems, the products that are no longer sustainable.
Yeah.
You can't be sentimental about the stuff that's holding you back if you want the organization to survive and adapt.
And societally, globally.
Well, the obvious application right now is climate change. Using Diamond's lens, you see immediately what's required. First, genuine global acknowledgement of the scale and urgency, which we're still struggling with in some places.
Then massive international cooperation.
Unprecedented international cooperation. That's the getting help from others factor on a global scale. And finally, fundamental, deeply uncomfortable flexibility in how we use energy, how we consume, how our economies are structured.
It's like the ultimate test of this entire framework played out globally.
It really feels that way.
So wrapping up, what's the thing that most surprised you or that you loved most about this approach?
For me, it's how it takes this overwhelming, confusing chaos of national or global crises and turns it into, well, an actionable process.
Yeah, I agree. It kind of demystifies it. It gives you a map, that checklist, instead of just feeling helpless despair. It restores a sense of agency, even when looking at huge problems.
Absolutely. And for me, the final resonant lesson is just how porous that boundary is between individual psychology and national resilience. It's not just a clever analogy. There seems to be a real connection. And the implication is huge. Recovery, whether personal or national, isn't just something that happens to you passively over time.
It's a learnable process.
It's a learnable process based on identifiable steps. And understanding those steps, the ones Diamond outlines, gives us individually and collectively a bit more power to shape our future, even in really turbulent times. Upheaval ends up being less a history book and more maybe a handbook for navigating the crises we're all facing.
A challenging but ultimately empowering thought.
See you next time with another remarkable maker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.